Pillar Network will be launching its own podcast beginning the first week of April. Podcasts focus on lessons for planting and revitalizing churches, as well as common questions for pastoring. This will be done under a banner of Pillar's belief and DNA of biblical authority, gospel proclamation, live expository preaching, elder-led congregationalism, being confessionally baptistic, and kingdom-minded associating and cooperation for the starting and strengthening of churches to the ends of the earth. You'll hear more in the coming days about this podcast, and to find out more, go to thepillarnetwork.com.
Baptist 21 is a pastor-led voice for Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The B21 podcast will discuss current issues in the SBC with Southern Baptist church leaders. To check out more resources, visit us at baptist21.com.
Welcome to the Baptist 21 podcast. I'm your host, Nate Aiken, and we're talking today, as we always do, about what it means to be Baptist in the 21st century. And I have with me today A.J. Smith. A.J. is a teacher at Brooklane Baptist Academy in Alabama, but also the author of The Making of the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message. And I was about to say Baptist Faith and Message 2000, but it was the Baptist Faith and Message 1963, which we're going to talk about today. So, A.J., thanks for taking time to be on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell me just a little bit about the background, kind of what's the background going into the 1963 convention or even really the 1962 convention that's going to obviously produce a committee and so forth that will bring us the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message. But could you just tell us sort of historically and in the convention, what are the sort of things in the background taking place that will bring us to that moment?
Well, a number of things. You had as early as 1958 at Southern Seminary, you had the purge of 1958, where Dr. McCall fired, I think, 19 faculty in a single day.
Yeah, they call the Lexington Road Massacre.
Yeah, and they were terminated because they were too bold and direct in their advocating of a liberal shift in Baptist theology. But almost all of them ended up on the initial faculty at the new launch of Midwestern in, 1959, 1960.
Yeah.
So they all landed on their feet. They just got
at Midwestern
relocated. Yeah. Well, before the purge happened, Dr. Elliott and Dr. Francisco had been asked by Broadman and Hallman to collaborate together on a modest introduction for Southern Baptists to modern scholarship regarding the Pentateuch. Mm-hmm. Dr. Francisco didn't have time, so he handed the whole work off to Dr. Elliott, and Dr. Elliott produced The Message of Genesis, which was published by Broadman and Hallman. And Dr. K. Owen White at First Baptist Church Houston read it and responded almost immediately with a letter to the editor, I believe it was to the Baptist Standard in Texas, entitled, "There's Death in the Pot."
Hmm.
And at the same time, Dr. Moody had gone to a pastor's conference in, I believe it was Shawnee, Oklahoma. And while talking with pastors out under a shade tree, he was understood to be advocating that genuine believers could fall from grace and lose their salvation. And Dr. Moody was on faculty that time teaching theology at Southern Seminary. So both of these events raised alarms throughout the convention.
Mm-hmm.
So The Making of Genesis and the Elliott controversy were the two pivotal events that hurled into the foreground the issue of Baptist confessionalism and what do we want taught in our schools.
Yeah.
And so a motion was made at the 1961 convention or the 62 convention for the formation of a new committee on Baptist faith and message.
Okay.
And
yeah, if you've ever read the I've read Ralph Elliott's what he called the Genesis controversy. It's a book he wrote talking about everything kind of going in that from his perspective, which is pretty fascinating, especially in there where he kind of advocates for what he calls double speak,
Yes.
And how they would say one thing to the churches about their theology, and they'd say one thing in the academy.
They would use the same words, but they would have a different, they'd have a personal meaning of that word. They'd take a word that everybody understood in one way. They would use it without explanation, but what they intended and meant by that was something different.
Mm. So in 62 or 61, I mean, maybe we'll find that specifically when they form the committee. But the person who's at the forefront of this, of the committee, is Herschel Hobbes.
Yes.
Can you just give us a little bit about who he is, like his background? Before we'll get into his specific significance for this making of the 1963, but just give us background into why he was a central figure in Southern Baptist life.
Well, Herschel Hobbes grew up right here in Alabama, just 50 miles from where I live. Well, not even from where I live, probably 20, 25 miles from where I live. His name is number 100 on the Enon Baptist Church roll, and they have the Herschel Hobbes Fellowship Hall. He went to then Howard College, now Samford University, and pastored here in Birmingham, and then went to Southern Seminary. He and W.A. Criswell were at Southern at the same time, though they weren't. One of them was a year or two ahead of the other, and I don't remember which one was which. But they were pretty close to the same age. They knew each other. They were good friends. And, of course, Herschel Hobbes, at this point, was president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And there's a whole side story to how the executive committee used to handpick who was going to be the next president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And then they would orchestrate things so that that person was elected president of the convention. And he always had to be a cooperating conservative. That's the term they used, a cooperating conservative. And by that, they meant somebody who was known to the convention to have conservative theology, but was broad-minded enough to let the academy do its thing uninterrupted.
Mm. Wow.
And so Herschel Hobbes was really handpicked to be the next president of the convention. They didn't know when he was chosen that this was all going to go down. And then it happened. And as president of the convention, he chaired the committee.
Yeah.
And the way the motion was written and the way it passed, the committee was composed of the presidents of the state conventions.
Oh, wow. Was it a pretty big committee?
It was a pretty big committee. It was a pretty big committee. I think there were 38 state conventions at the time. I don't remember. It was a sizable, wow. It was a sizable committee. But it was all the presidents of the state conventions were on the committee.
Mm.
And then the committee consulted with the faculty of the various seminaries.
Okay. Wow. Even Midwestern.
And you can go to Midwestern and pull the Bergquist archives, and you can find all of the Midwestern records are there. The only other school that has any records that I can put my hands on were at Southern. I did get to see the Moody files, and Dr. Wayne Ward graciously shared with me everything he had. So that, Dr. Patterson was at Southwestern. No, he was at Southeastern when I was writing. He scoured Southeastern, couldn't find anything there. They couldn't find anything at Southwestern. Dr. Nettles seemed to think that Dr. Naylor probably took with him any files related to the Baptist faith and message. And Midwestern and Golden Gate were brand new at the time. And Golden Gate, if they had any involvement, it was minimal. I do have in my book, they sent a copy of the first draft of the 63 to Mercer University. Okay. And I have Mercer's feedback on that. Mercer's faculty actually accused the committee of taking the doctrine of salvation in a Pelagian direction.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, So you have all this controversy, obviously swirling because of Ralph Elliott and Francisco and others you mentioned. Even as far back as the early 60s, the shift towards liberalism that would later cause the conservative resurgence is obvious, or at least not obvious. It's the beginning of some of those things. So this is the kind of the milieu that this whole committee gets formed in. Can you tell us some then about the particulars of the committee before it actually comes to the floor? What are the points of contention? There's some adjustments to the 1925. Can you take us through some of those aspects of the 1963?
The committee records are extremely sparse. The actual committee records tell us when and where they met and who was on what subcommittee. And that's about all the committee records themselves tell us. They don't tell us any of the debate, anything that went on internally in the committee. None of that is in the committee records. And those records are at the archives in Nashville.
Okay.
And they're cited in my book, so you can go find them. And so, but I know when I went to Nashville and I started going through the file, the first thing I found was I found this copy, this early draft of the 63, and I found a letter from a member of the committee to Dr. Ward at Southern Seminary, and I found Dr. Ward's response, and the response that Dr. Ward had in his letter matched the handwritten comments in that draft. And so I called Dr. Ward because he lived right across the street from the seminary. He agreed to meet me. I showed him what I had, and I said, "Are these your notes?" He said, "Yeah, you want the originals?" And he went home and he brought me all of his original documents.
Wow.
And so the original draft, the statement on Jesus Christ and the interpretation of Scripture, very different in the original draft than the final draft. And that was a Dale Moody concession.
Okay.
And curiously enough,
I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about that in a minute, because you said before we got on that Dale said he had many concessions. I want to ask you about that in a minute, but keep going with what you're talking about.
So then I had the copy that I knew was from Mercer. So I have those as appendices in the book. You can see the original, the one that the Dr. Ward had was the first draft that came out of the committee. Right. Then you have the draft that comes out of the Mercer review. And then you get what they start doing. They start meeting with select faculty members from the different seminaries. And each seminary was assigned a 2-man subcommittee to go meet with their faculty. Oh, wow. And those are the records that are really hard to get a handle on. But Dr. Moody's personal records that are at Southern Seminary contain most of the information from that. Dr. Garrett was in Switzerland at the time, but he also communicated with the committee and provided them with the doctrinal statement from Gambrel Street Baptist Church in Fort Worth. And the article on eschatology was used as a basis for the article on the kingdom in the 1963 okay. Baptist Faith and Message. And Dr. Garrett was very gracious in communicating with me. We had a number of exchanges, and he was very gracious and very helpful. So I have a high appreciation for Dr. Garrett and for Dr. Ward. They were extremely helpful to me, and they were directly involved.
Okay. How you had mentioned before we came on that Dale Moody said he got several concessions. What were those concessions in his mind, or how do you see that playing out? Dale Moody, of course, was a liberal professor at Southern, for people who don't know. So him saying he got concessions put in is an interesting statement. But, yeah, talk us through that.
Dale Moody, well, we know about Article 1 in the Baptist Faith and Message statement on Scripture. I want to read to you the original wording of that key sentence. The original wording was, the criterion by which the Bible is to be interpreted is the person, work, and teachings of Jesus Christ. Person, work, and teachings gets struck. And that's a Dale Moody recommendation. Specifically, what Moody said was, if we leave that in there, fundamentalists will argue for the unity of Isaiah, the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, and an early date for Daniel.
So talk us through then what the change ends up being.
So the change ended up being the criterion by which the Bible is to be interpreted is Jesus Christ.
And that was an acceptable change to Dale Moody?
That was an acceptable, that was Dale Moody's recommended change.
Wow. And so he viewed even the previous one as something that would be pro, in his words, I guess, fundamentalists would be in favor of.
Yes. The previous wording was something fundamentalists would be in favor of. And I talked to one of the retired Old Testament professors. I'm trying to remember his name now. Marvin. I can't think of his last name. He was a retired Old Testament professor when I was there. He and I talked about this in the break room one day. And he said, at that time, he said, I was a junior member of the faculty. Nobody listened to me. But he said, when Moody suggested that wording and I saw it, he said, and he was a liberal. He said, I said to them then, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. And he admitted that the 2000 Baptist Faith and Message statement that replaces that is much more biblical and more accurate.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's always been the line that when some people now won't change from the, I mean, there had been churches that wouldn't change from the 1963 to the 2000, and that line was the sticking point. And even then, they're saying, we don't know fully what that means.
Yeah, that line is a wax nose. You can shape it to whatever you want it to be.
Why would Herschel Hobbes have allowed that?
I don't know. But what Hobbes intended, and this was in response to the Eliot controversy. Eliot had argued in his book, if you've read his book, he argues that Melchizedek was a priest of Baal. And that creates problems for the book of Hebrews, where Melchizedek is a type of Christ.
Right.
And so what Hobbes had in his mind, in his thinking was, we've got to tie this together so that people cannot equate Melchizedek with Baal. We've got to close this loop so that it's clear that when the scripture talks about, uses typology to refer to Jesus, that it's referring to Jesus. And that's what's on that's what's on Hobbes's mind.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So was there much, do you know if there's much debate and contention from the floor over the, when the committee brings the confession to the floor of the SBC in 1963?
No, not really. There wasn't much. The confession passed pretty easily. What they expected debate over was changes in the article on the church. The 63 was the first version that acknowledged a universal church of all believers throughout the ages. It's the first confession since the Second London to do that. Yeah. And so they were anticipating landmarkists to rise up against that. Yeah. But that didn't happen. And Hobbes actually had, he had in hand notes from Pendleton, Graves, and others that affirmed a universal church idea, just in case that came up on the floor. No, it passed pretty easily.
That is, I mean, nothing passes very easily in Southern Baptist life. So that's fascinating to hear. But what is the purpose of the 1963? How is it supposed to operate and act in the life of the Southern Baptist Convention?
Well, it was supposed to act not in terms of the local churches, but it was supposed to serve as a guide for convention agency. So it was supposed to be used by the Foreign and Home Mission Board, by the Sunday School Board, these agencies in terms of their publication, in terms of their hiring. Dr. Ward anticipated in a letter that seminary faculty would be required at some point perhaps to sign it, just as at Southern and at Southeastern, they were required to sign the abstract of principles. And so he anticipated that, which now, I don't know if you know, I've taught some for New Orleans. When you teach at New Orleans, you sign New Orleans Seminary Confession and the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 to teach in accordance with and not contrary to as a condition of employment. In our Southern Baptist seminaries, you sign the Baptist Faith and Message as well as the seminary's own doctrinal statement.
Well, and what's interesting, though, in that, so both in having a conversation about the 1925 and the 1963, is that because they tried to remain, they would not like this term, but they were in some sense moderate in the sense of a more, a less tight confession and a less tight application of what that would mean to the life of the SBC, that then also led to the, you know, the need for conservative resurgence and other things down the line. And so, in some sense, 1925 and then 1963 sort of pushed the ball down, kind of pushed the can down the road before dealing with it again another, you know, a few decades later.
Yeah, the main issue with the 25 was dealing with the evolution question.
Right.
That was the main issue that pushed the 25. Then the 63, the main issue was eternal security of the believer and the Eliot controversy with regard to scripture. And Hobbes and other members of the committee very clear in later writings and interviews that they intended the article on scripture to be interpreted as affirming inerrancy.
Even though many who did not affirm inerrancy used that criterion language to state the opposite.
Well, and the other thing that you get in the 63 is Hobbes introduces this change of language. Instead of the Bible being God's revelation, the Bible is the record of God's revelation.
Yeah.
And that's actually a 19th century liberal concept.
Right.
And to the extent, to what extent does Hobbes realize how he's choosing this language is influenced by that or not, is hard to say.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was, I was a kid I was a young kid in the 80s and then went to school, college in the late 90s or early 2000s. And I had a professor who was my chair. He was a political science professor, but had moderate to liberal CBF type convictions. And so he said to me one time, it was a political science consultation, but somehow we started talking about the Bible. And he said to me, and I didn't know it at the time, but it's interesting coming out of the 1963, he said, "I prefer the words of Jesus over the words of Paul." And I didn't know what that meant at the time. I thought, that's a strange statement. And I asked my dad, and I was like, what does that
canon
mean? Like,
yeah,
that's a liberal statement is basically what he said. Yeah. He said, yeah, he's been influenced by the old Southern. And so that sort of thing. It was kind of a fascinating conversation. Some of that is again, there are people who hold to the 63 and think they can say that because of that statement and then be okay with the confession.
Yeah. And so that's the idea of there's a canon within the canon, that Jesus in the Gospels is the interpretive key to the rest of it, and that somehow the words of Jesus are more inspired than the words of Paul or the words of Peter or whoever else.
Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating to think through how not dealing with it in 63 then leads to some of the things you have in the institutions and the convention at large down the road. Any final thoughts on the 1963, maybe even any fun tidbits that in your research that kind of came out other than some of the things you've already brought up?
There were other things going on in the country that concerned the committee, and they were concerned with the civil rights movement. They were concerned with communism. They were concerned with the rising materialism that was prevalent in the churches. They were concerned with the rising divorce rate, which was minuscule compared to today. On the issue of race, I want to read something to you from the original draft. And I want you to think about this in light of the 2000 Baptist Faith and Message. Only the grace of God can bring man back into his holy fellowship and enable him to fulfill the purpose of his creation. The fact that man was created, this is what I want you to hear. The fact that man was created in the image of God and that Christ died for him bespeaks the sacredness of human personality. As such, he possesses dignity and is worthy of respect and Christian love, regardless of race or class. Now, this phrase, regardless of race or class, got cut from the final draft. And Hobbes, having grown up in the Deep South, understood, in light of what happened when Dr. King came to Southern Seminary to speak during, I don't want our listeners to misunderstand this. The lectures are called the Gay Lectures because they were funded by a family whose last name was Gay, G-A-Y. Dr. King came to speak in 1961 at the Gay Lectures. Alabama literally suspended their cooperative program dollars to Southern Seminary until Dr. McCall apologized for having that agitator, as they called him, at Southern Seminary. And so in typical Southern fashion, Dr. McCall issued a non-apology apology, and Alabama loosened its purse strings again. What most people don't know, Dr. Ward told me this, is that Dr. King, when he was there, was offered a teaching position on the faculty in the preaching department, and he turned it down. He said, I am like Nehemiah upon the wall. I have a work to do, and I cannot come down. And so this phrase, Dr. Hobbs said, we've got to address the race issue in the convention, but it's going to have to be done over time and incrementally. Dr. Hobbs' successor, K. Owen White, is the only president of the Southern Baptist Convention to resign rather than finish his term. And he resigned precisely because he could not lead First Baptist Houston to accept Black people into the congregation. He said, if I can't lead my church to accept Black people into the church, I have no right being president of the Southern Baptist Convention.
I didn't know that.
So the race
issue. First time I've heard that story.
The race issue was on the minds of the committee, but they felt it too explosive to tackle head on. There was actually just like we had a resolution in the 1990s on race. There was one in the 1940s. Most people don't know it, but there was a resolution on race, a very good one, that was passed through the convention in the 1940s. I don't remember the exact year now. So the race issue was a big issue to the committee. The civil rights movement was a big issue to the committee. And but they felt like it was too explosive in the climate to tackle directly. Dr. Hobbs could not get Black people in his church in Oklahoma either. As a matter of fact, there was a Black protest in front of his church.
Well, so that's another issue that just doesn't get addressed in the moment. And obviously the effects of that linger in the Southern Baptist Convention.
And it's not because Dr. Hobbs and the committee didn't want to address it. It's that they knew that in that climate, they couldn't address it without blowing up everything, that it was going to take time. And I read letters from average Southern Baptist, small town Southern Baptist, to Dr. Hobbs about the civil rights movement. And they acknowledge what I saw in my own father was a kind of disconnect where when they knew somebody personally who was Black and they got to know them, they became really good friends. But when they thought of Black people as a group, it was a completely different thing. And one woman from, I think, Floydada, Texas, wrote to Dr. Hobbs and said, I know in my mind that this is wrong, but in my heart, I can't get past this. This is the fallenness of human nature.
Yep.
That we have these things we struggle with, and they take time.
Well, that's a fascinating look into what was also going on in the culture going yes. into this committee, having to write the 1963 and even just what was going on in the convention. Well, brother, we thank you so much for just filling us in on really just helpful information on the 1963. I think most of our listeners would have very little understanding of what was going on in that convention. Myself, who reads a lot about history, that is probably one era of this that I have very little information about, very little knowledge of. And so I appreciate you taking time to be on the podcast.
My dissertation, the making of the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message, is published by Wiffenstock in paperback, is available also as an ebook. And so if people want to know more, they can get the book.
Yeah. We'll put a link to both in the notes on this episode. And again, we thank you so much for being on the Baptist 21 podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Baptist 21 podcast. To learn more about us, visit us at our website, baptist21.com. Also, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with others. It would really help us out. If you ever have thoughts or ideas for future interviews, please reach out to us at our email, baptist21@gmail.com. Again, thanks for listening to the podcast.